Welcome, friends. Welcome to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you once again from the North American Architect Forum, where I'm having just a lot of fun and talking to a lot of architects. And I'm also doing this kind of interesting project for people who want to become architects, kind of aspiring architects. And so I've been asking people, you know, well, how did you become an architect? And what does an architect do anyway? I mean, and what kind of things do you do? And it's been really interesting to hear the answers to these questions. And it turns out that a lot of people just became architects because they've been around a long time. And they go, well, we don't know what to call you now. You've been here so long, you're an architect. So maybe that's the way you become an architect. But I think there's more to it than that. And so does my guest on today's show, Robert Deneau, is an architect for Monster.com. So let's welcome Robert Deneau. Welcome back. This is Ron Jacobs, your host on ArtCast, where we are at the North American Architect Forum here in the lovely Vail Cascade Resort and Spa here in Vail, Colorado, high above the lower down valley where snow is still on the mountain. And I am joined by Robert Deneau.
Deneau, yes.
Yeah, okay. I said it right. Okay.
That's fine.
And Robert, you had some time to get out on the mountain here, didn't you?
I certainly did, and you know, it's kind of a little bit distracting. You get up there, you forget that the sun is shining brightly, and I caught a little bit too much sun, and so I look a bit like a raccoon today.
I wasn't going to say anything, you know, but you know, but and of course, you've been working very hard while you've been on this trip.
Of course. And hopefully my boss is not listening.
But that's what architects do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Work hard, play hard.
Yeah, you know, and so all the developers are back there slaving away over their, mm-hmm. you know, keyboards and cranking out the code, and you're here soaking up the sun and snow.
I do some of my best thinking on my way down the hills.
Well, that's right. We are about thinking. And in fact, I'm thinking that today we should talk about what it means to be an architect. How do you become one anyway? Because, you know, a lot of people are thinking about this.
Sure.
And, we did actually an ArtCast a while back called Developer 2.0. And one of my colleagues, Harry Pearson, has done a lot of thinking about this. And in that talk, we thought about the issues of globalization are hitting us. And, mm-hmm. and you know, a lot of companies are sending development work offshore. And so if you're just kind of a core developer, you might be a little bit worried about the career. And so you're thinking, well, maybe I ought to think about becoming more of an architect. Now, it's been my experience that most people that have the label architect on them just kind of had it slapped on them at some point. You know, like, hey, you've been around here a long time. You must be an architect.
Right, you know? Right.
And so I'd be interested to hear about, first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you got there.
Sure. Yeah. Once again, name is Rob Deneau, and I'm a director of platform architecture for Monster.com. I've been in the IT industry for maybe about, over 15 years, I say, at this point. So I've definitely paid my dues. And, you know, I think that's one of those things that might be a prerequisite to becoming an architect. You actually have to have seen a few things happen along the way, the good and the bad. And it's by learning from all those things that you bring to the table some wisdom in how to achieve whatever the goals of your project might be. I started programming in high school. I think my first computer was a Trash 80 color computer with 16K of RAM.
Whoa!
whopping. So, yeah, we really needed to learn how to program tightly, and the language there was assembler. Long story short, I went through many different programming languages. I worked on small and large projects. I've seen more methodologies than I can count. And it's my belief that there's really nothing new under the sun. So even we look at things like Agile these days, and I can see reflections of other methodologies from the past. So how did I get to this particular stage? I think it is really by having spent my time on a lot of projects. I spent a fair amount of my career in the consulting world, so that means a lot of projects in very rapid succession. I've been on the death marches, so you come to find out what are the common causes for things going south. And, you know, one interesting thing that I see over and over again is that it's never really a technical problem. It's usually some sort of people issue, whether it be a decision or just the dynamics that occur between people on projects.
It's funny that you mentioned it's not a technical problem, right? Because oftentimes, you know, people get jazzed about the latest technology. Mm. And they're like, whoa, we got this new object-oriented thing, that's going to save us for sure because, you know, that's going to solve every problem we've ever had. And then we found the same old problems followed us in when we started using object-oriented things. It was the same problems because the problem wasn't the technology, but it was the people.
Right.
And even are we solving the right problem?
Right, right. And we're seeing it all over again now, aren't we, with SOAR? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So is the next silver bullet. It promises something that's probably more than it can deliver in the end. But when we even come back to deciding whether or not to use SOA, that's a personal decision there. Where is it right to use those sort of things?
So it's pretty obvious to me when you think about, well, what does a developer do? That's a no-brainer, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they sit there and they write code, you know? And at the end of the day, they do a build and you get myprogram.exe, yeah. And we know what a developer does. They do something very concrete. It's actually much harder to understand what an architect does. So what does an architect do?
So, you know, I don't know that we have concurrence on what it means to be an architect. I think we're still debating what this is, and it's my opinion that the reason there is that we're all grasping at one common definition for an architect when, in fact, I think there are really many different types of architects out there. And one way, I think, to assess what type of architect you might be is to look at really two dimensions, if you will. One is a time aspect, and another is a breadth or scope of concern. So, for example, if you are more concerned with tactical issues, you might be one type of architect. That is, if you're really getting down into how to design object models or how to layer an application or whether or not to even use layering, you're going to be more into the weeds. But if you're thinking about strategic sort of concerns, that is, whether or not to even pull in to your mix an enterprise service bus sort of concept, or how to best layer in service-oriented architecture, whether or not to even use SOA. Those are probably more strategic concerns. And you'll be, I would say, a different sort of architect there as well. On another dimension, there is the breadth of your concern, which is the types of projects you're involved in, whether you're involved in just one project or many projects. So if you're involved with one project or product, you're a certain type of architect. For example, maybe you're a solution architect on a particular product. You're going to be very tactical, thinking about object models, thinking about solving the problems of a particular product design. If you're involved in a number of products or projects, then you might be more of an enterprise architect. And you're probably not going to be so caught up in the specific implementation details. That is, what are the interfaces, what are the designs for different objects and so forth. You might just set a general direction for your teams and then point them in that direction and let them go. So I think there really is kind of a continuum of different architects. Once somewhere around the time you hit a senior sort of role, on up through, say, a CTO of a company. Even that person could be considered an architect.
You know, when you think about it, when you get up in a plane and you look out the window, I mean, things look really different, right? I mean, you look at little tiny trees and farmhouses and land, and up there you can see things that you could not see at the ground level, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you see the patterns in the way the farmer plows the field, and you see interesting patterns about how the neighborhoods are formed in cities. And I always spend some time thinking about this as I fly a lot. I'm looking out the windows of planes, It seems to me that that's a good way of thinking about the continuum you described, is that, like, the developer is like the guy down in the trenches, man. He's digging ditches and pouring foundations and swinging the hammer. And then you go up a few hundred feet or 1,000 feet or so, and you've got the solution architect who's looking at that project, that building, and they see, like, oh, there's the bedroom, there's the master suite, there's the garage. You know, they're looking at all parts of the whole structure and how it all fits together and how it's laid out on the site. And then there's the guy up in the airplane, kind of the enterprise architect, is looking at how that project fits in that neighborhood and how it fits in the flow of the whole structure of the area. And the thing I found is that you have to be prepared to live with the level you're going to work at.
Right.
So I found it kind of hard as I moved up off the ground, because sometimes you're up there at 1,000 feet and you're going, like, you're looking at the guy down there swinging a hammer, you're going, he is doing that all wrong, man. I could get down there and swing that hammer better than he could. And sometimes you kind of miss the old days when you swung a hammer, right?
Right.
But it's not your role to get down there and mess with that.
Absolutely not. And I think that's one of the common misnomers about becoming an architect, especially as you rise up through the ranks, where that, hey, just if I just had that authority, if I was at this particular level, then everything would work wonderfully because I know the right solution. And that's totally the wrong approach. Because, number one, there'll become this antagonism between the individual product teams and what you're trying to achieve for the company, let's say if you're in an enterprise architect sort of role. So really, there needs to be kind of more of a collaborative approach between the two. And quite often I find in a number of companies that even at the enterprise architect, there really isn't that sort of authority. So we need to learn how to influence and negotiate, and really you become more of a diplomat. And you're trying to, what you need to help them do is find out opportunities for sharing their common solutions out to the organization as a whole. So it's really important to have different perspectives. The worst thing that enterprise architects can do is become a bottleneck, really, for the individual product teams. Especially in the cases when, you know, they don't have that sort of authority to make certain things happen. They have to essentially encourage innovation, and then the analogy I like to use is like a mountain guide. You let them climb, you let them make mistakes, but when they really need help, you're there to show them the way through.
Oh, yeah, so when the blizzard comes on and they're like, we're going to die, you're like, nope, this is the way.
yeah, here's the way. I know the way out. Been there. Exactly. Which is why I think, you know, once to become an architect, you probably have had to been through a few good events, a few bad events, and you don't just come into that role because you're a great engineer, which, you know, probably is a good thing for you to be, but you have to have lived some life.
Well, in fact, you have to be prepared to give up the technical depth that
right.
you had when you were a great engineer.
Right.
Right. Like, so, you know, like it hit me one day when I was talking to somebody, a dev lead on this project, and I was trying to sketch out an idea for him, and I said, you know, and I started writing some code on the board, and he's like, you don't do it that way. You know, I went, oh yeah, it's been so long since I've written this. You know, I kind of got some things out of place, and, you know, and I thought, holy cow, I've kind of lost. I used to be so good at, like, just slapping out code, you know, and I'm sure if I had to do it again, you know, it'd take me very long to get in and do it. But I had to kind of be willing to give up the role of being the guy who knew how to do every little low-level thing.
Well, it's impossible. You can't. Your concern as an architect typically is much broader. And the way I describe it there is that, you know, I tend to be a mile wide and an inch deep.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows me to communicate with point specialists. And you still need those point specialists. And those are the guys you turn to. And rather than saying, hey, do it this way, you give them a challenge. You point them in the general direction, and you let their creativity and their passion run wild. And that seems to work pretty well, I think, for a lot of solution architects and engineers.
Well, and I had to kind of step back and say, you know, there's value in both roles.
Mm-hmm.
In some organization, they're like, well, you know, we want the developers. Those are the guys who really, you know, get something done. This architect guy, all he ever does is have meetings and draw stuff on boards, you know, and who knows what that is. Is there any value in that? But actually, when you step back for a minute, you look at huge project failures.
Mm.
They were almost never because developers didn't write enough code.
Right.
I mean, I can't think of a single one that I've ever seen that happened that way. There was usually plenty of code, tons of it, you know. But generally, the problem was the code was solving the wrong problem. The subsystems didn't fit together well. There were architectural problems.
Exactly. And which kind of hints at another key aspect of an architect's role, which is to align the proper use of technology to solve a business problem. And in the end, that's what we're here to do. We're about using technology to solve a business problem. And for example, let's say if we're in the business of, selling products over the internet. Now, if we're developing low-level infrastructure, such as, batch job management systems, then, you know, maybe we're solving the wrong sort of issue. Now, that's not our business at all. We should be buying that sort of thing off the shelf. Now, if you just, you know, you leave it to an engineer, they might say, hey, well, we got this batch job that needs to be done. I'll get to work writing it. You know, their intent is in the right place, but the big picture is, hey, that's not the core business problem. The architect can step in and say, look, you know, this is a problem that has already been solved. Rather than reinventing the wheel and solving this problem again, there are many options we can get off the shelf. So that's another key thing that the architect brings to the table. When we need to solve a problem by building it ourselves, and when we can just pick something off the shelf and integrate that into our big solution.
Yeah, and so the guy down in the trenches, I mean, that's all he can see. He's like, yeah, I got a shovel, I got a hammer, man, I'm going to build something.
That's right.
And the guy up in the airplane is like, hey, wait a minute, you know, you can go right over there and get the thing you need, and we don't have to build that.
The answer's right in front of you. Yeah, let's not reinvent the wheel. Yeah.
So there's a lot of value to the role of architect, but I'm thinking, you know, well, what kind of skills does this person need? So we talked a little, they need to have a little bit of technical background. Obviously, you wouldn't want an architect who has no idea about the technology. That wouldn't work. But what other kind of skills do they need?
I think that it's a very broad range of skills. Probably the obvious one has to do with your engineering acumen. You have to have some background in how to design systems using languages and so forth. But stepping off into a different direction, requirements definition, and you know, there are many different approaches to doing this, whether it be use cases or user stories, if you're into a agile sort of framework, you have to understand the different methodologies for going about that. Because remember, once again, it's about solving a business problem. And if you don't define what that goal is, then it doesn't matter how well you build it, you're off into the wrong direction. So architects really help in that respect and bring into the practice those sort of disciplines. Also, another issue I would say is the idea of layering, you know, a very basic idea in architecture, how to separate concerns and responsibilities one from another. And we're all pretty familiar with what the basic ones are. We have presentation tier or layer. We have our domain layer, our business object model, we might call it, and our data access layer. So something we need to, I think, get very familiar with. We should probably have some familiarity with the common design patterns that have entered the vernacular. And so here I'm referring to Gang of Four, the famous book, and also more recently such things as Fowler's book on enterprise application patterns, integration patterns, and so forth. And when you start talking about patterns, people sometimes get a little bit glossy eye and they start saying, gee, how do I apply this pattern or that pattern? And I think that really, you know, don't make too much of that, because patterns are really just labels that we apply to solutions that we have seen worked in the past. So, for example, if we are driving down the highway and we want to go from, let's say, turn off going north to going east, we might enter a cloverleaf. Well, that's an example of a design pattern. In this case, it's civil engineering. So the way I kind of coach people to think about patterns is that we don't go looking for places to apply patterns. We go looking to solve a problem, and then quite oftentimes we'll go, aha, that looks like such and such a pattern. So that's just another thing. Obviously, object-oriented sort of design concepts. And then these days as well, you might want to know a little bit about some other alternatives like SOA, service-oriented architectures. And the list really goes on and on. You know, project management concerns, estimating approaches, the pros and cons of centralized versus distributed design, testing, and I did say project management, didn't I? Oh, relational database management theory. It's kind of funny that it seems like a lot of people have been lumped into, let's say, if you're an application engineer or architect, that you don't need to know anything about the back end and how databases are designed. But I'm one of those people who says, you know what, in the end, it's all about pushing stuff out to disk and pulling it back off again. So we should have some idea of how to best store that information into a database. Since that's typically what we're going to be doing. One more thing I'd add to this list, if I may, the idea of different modeling techniques. And this just keeps changing all the time. So I would say out of the UML toolkit, you probably want to have some understanding of things like static object models and sequence diagrams. I think you should understand how to do entity relationship diagrams. And then maybe even some more old-time approaches, such as flow charting and data flow diagrams as well.
Wow, that's quite a menu. But you know, I think the interesting thing to me about modeling, when I thought about, well, what's the big deal about models and modeling? Seems to me that the architect deals in the realm of ideas. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is not concrete things that you can point out. Look at that code; it's not built yet, right? Yep. Somebody has to get the idea right first, and so that's the trick, isn't it? Getting the idea right. But how do I, if I have an idea in my head, how do I know if it's right? Well, I'm going to review it with other people. I'm going to sit down with you. I'm going to say, hey, Robert, I have this cool idea. I think we ought to build it this way. You know, and oftentimes you see architects, you know, drawing, sketching things out on whiteboards and kind of diagramming stuff. And so models are just kind of an agreed upon diagram. You know, yeah. That way we're going to do something.
It's make nothing more of it than a form of communication. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people spend way too much time in developing pretty pictures. For example, use case diagrams.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see these use cases with a little bubble in the middle and yeah. stick figures and, you know.
I don't get that.
It doesn't really give you the sort of payback that you put into to producing that diagram.
Yeah.
But if you can draw a picture and with that one picture express 1,000 words and be able to find the pros and cons of the direction you want to take with your design, then it served its purpose. But it shouldn't be the end goal in itself. It's a way to validate the approaches that you want to take.
Well, and I think really, I look at people who are good architects and I see they're most often very good communicators. Mm. Because they have to communicate to a broad range of people. So one time they were sitting down talking very technically with the developers about the nature of how something ought to be implemented. Another time they're in a meeting with the CEO talking about how this system's going to deliver business value to the organization. And they have to be able to scale these language barriers between technical and non-technical.
Yeah, you're almost, I'd call it like a language interpreter. Uh-huh. You know how to communicate in the tech geek language, and you know how to communicate in the language of business. And how each of those particular approaches, or I should say, how the technology serves those business ends. So, in the case of, let's take SOA again, and that's one of our famous discussions this weekend.
Yeah.
If a group is saying, hey, we got to adopt SOA, and gee, let's make the investment in on Windows Communication Framework or Indigo, then we need to get approval from the business. How do we do it? Well, we have to, as architects, translate that into something that's a little less techie for the business folks, and why that's a payback for them, why they should put the money into training and putting that into their infrastructure. And then likewise, if the business is saying, hey, you know, we got to get this release out faster, or we want to push this function into it and so forth, we have to be able to translate that into essentially more cut and dry language for the engineers, because engineers see straight through all that flowery sort of go get them sort of speech from the business. So you're a bit of a liaison there, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, and so sometimes also you have to be the advocate that, you know, that's gonna go to bat for the project team and say, when the business says, hey, we have to have this next week, and you're like, it can't be done, right, and we're not gonna ask the guys to do it that way. You know, this is the day we can deliver, and sometimes you have to be the advocate for the business who's asking for something and the techie people don't want to do it, right? And you say, no, you know, this is the business. It's funny because early in my career when I was slinging code for a living, right, I never thought about the business. I never thought about, well, how does building this thing help our business make more money? I never thought about where's all this money coming from to pay my salary so that I can sit here slinging code? Man, I didn't think about that stuff at all. I just thought, I have to write the XYZ system or whatever it is, and boom, you know, I'm just doing it. And I think at some point when you kind of raise your head up and say, we're doing this to solve a business problem, then you begin to get into how architects are accountable to the business for realizing some value.
Right, right. It's that is pretty much the mantra I try to live by, and I pass that little pearl of wisdom on where I can. You know, we love engineering, I think. We love the creativity and the mental gymnastics that are involved in it. But it's not the end in itself. It's totally not. It's about solving somebody's problem out there. And we can't lose sight of that.
Well, in effect, in your business, at Monster.com, of course, is in the business of it's the classic middleman, brokering deals between buyers and sellers, right? Except for you're brokering deals between employers and prospective employees,
right?
Who are looking for jobs, and you're in that middle space. The thing that's fascinating about your organization is it's all about information, right? You're not building widgets that you ship out and sell, and you can't go buy a thing that, you know, Monster.com makes. You buy a service that's information-based.
Right, and you know, when you think about it, most software is addressing information provided to different constituencies. In our particular case, our customers are two. We have job seekers, we have recruiters, and each has very different needs. On the recruiter side, they're obviously looking for people who are a good fit for whatever position they're opening up. So, as architects, we need to understand the different ways that people want to find those people who could fulfill those positions. And then, you know, similar sort of questions we need to ask on the job seeker side. How do people go about seeking a position? What sort of searches do they want to use? What sort of information do they want to provide about themselves? So it certainly starts with a need that's outside of selling any sort of tangible sort of product. It's all about information, collecting the right information and providing that right information to the different audiences, and then some smarts about how to bring that information together and do the matching between the two audiences.
Well, and this is where I think the really fun part of architecture comes in for me, right, is that you're in a competitive business, right? There's lots of people who have job sites,
right?
And you're only going to win if your business offers better service, better results for the people who are paying for the service, right? And so as the architect, you kind of rise a little bit above. You get away from, you know, web services and databases and object models, and you begin to think about this business and How does this technology enable this business? What could we build that would give us a competitive edge that would be better than what the other guys are doing?
Exactly. You know, that's a pretty neat point, because I recall that during this conference there's been a few topics such as the business value of architecture, the business value of SOA, for example, and how we sell that to the business. In my experience, the business doesn't care. You know, if I use technology A or technology B, or I architect it this way or that way, they don't care. They want results. They want more revenue. They want time to market faster. And whichever way gets you there is the best way.
Well, they're like, you know, it reminds me of the other day. Okay, I had this lawn service company, you know, that say, oh, well, you know, we spray chemicals and fertilizers on your lawn, you know, on a regular basis. We'll treat it, and then it will look great, mm-hmm. right? So I had them, for nearly a year, right? And then finally one day I looked at my lawn and I said, that doesn't look any better than it did before they started. I've been paying, you know, hundreds of dollars for more than a year. It looks just the same. So I called him up. I said, you guys are fired, man. I don't want you anymore. And they were like, what did we do? And I'm like, look at the grass. It looks exactly the same as when you started, and I have $400 less in my pocket. Tell me why that's a good thing.
Right.
And I think that's the way the business looks at this whole thing.
Yeah, they really don't care. They don't care if you use C# or VB or use .NET or Java. It's about getting a job done and, in the end, making money.
Exactly.
So whichever way gets you there, that's the right way.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Robert, for joining me today on ArtCast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Robert Deneau, ladies and gentlemen, from Monstra.com. Hey, if you're looking for a job as an architect, you could go to Monstra.com and put in your resume. Who knows? You might just find something there. And you know, there's... The interesting thing about this is, as I've talked to a lot of the people who have the label architect, I find that a lot of them are very interested in knowing what the role should be. Could it be that maybe a lot of people are kind of functioning in this role but don't really know everything that it ought to entail? I think that's true. And in fact, there's not a broad agreement in the industry about what an architect should be. Who knows? Maybe we'll come up with that here on ArtCast.